This is Meredith for Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. Here, we explore the taboo questions people think but don't ask out loud, questions that need nuanced answers unavailable even to Google. My mission, and yours if you choose to accept it, is to inspire curiosity within yourself and the world around you. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around. Real quick, before I jump into this week's episode, could you pause this and just check to see if you're following or subscribed or whatever it is that your podcast app calls it for the show? And if you're not, hit that little button for me so you never miss an episode. It's one less thing you have to do for the new year. This week's guest is a hybrid of story time and jobs that you didn't know existed. He's a prison consultant. Hopefully, none of you will ever need his services. He shares behind the scenes of working at a pill mill, the worst part of his prison experience, and what a prison consultant does. He also shares something that he's never shared before, which is his cocaine addiction after prison. If you end up liking this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a felon turned million-dollar entrepreneur, and that is episode 18, all the way back. All right, friends, keep it curious. There are life events we plan for and those we hope to never plan for. My next guest is someone who has done a lot of the latter. He was recruited to be an office manager at a Georgia pain clinic. The pain clinic was really a pill mill, and the pill mill was raided. And in 2014, he went to prison. But right before he did, he made a Hail Mary YouTube video asking for advice on how to survive a prison sentence. After serving two of his five-year sentence, he re-entered the world to discover the video had become popular. So he made a business. Now he's helped hundreds of people with his federal prison consulting services with sentence reduction and coaching. Today, he's going to share how the story of his struggles before and after prison have come so far and what prepping others for prison is all about. From behind bars to behind the mic, Florida man, RDAP Dan, Dan Wise. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Meredith, thank you very much, Florida man. You never get tired of hearing that one. How are you doing?
Good. You know I had to put that in there.
Yes,
I had
yes.
to.
I feel like I should have an alligator in the background or something.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't matter where you move, you'll always be a Florida man. You know, I was talking with some people like in the prep of this, and most people had known someone who'd been to prison, but most people had never heard of a prison consulting business, which is interesting to me. But most people have heard of, you know, the opioid crisis, and probably many of those people have had someone that they love affected by it. So I thought that would be a good place to start, since that's a central, it's like its own character in your story. And so I wanted to ask you, you were working at a call center, I believe is how the story goes, and you got an offer to work as an office manager at a pain clinic. When they offered you a monthly salary of $10,000. Did that like set off any alarm bells for you? Like maybe there's something up here.
It should have in the like the regular world, but the call center industry that I'd been in for so long that in sales oriented jobs, things of that nature, it wasn't unheard of to be able to make $10,000-$15,000 a month in a commission driven type of environment. But the red flags were there, and I just was so blinded by everything that I definitely avoided it.
So it felt sketchy, but you just decided to kind of push through it?
Yeah. You know, when everything you've done up until this point has probably been somewhat of a sketchy type of job, from credit repair to loan modifications to just shady mortgages, you kind of forget what shade looks like. You become so complacent in that world that you don't even feel like you're doing anything wrong.
I could see that. I could see where like your baseline of what is legitimate would probably be a little off kilter. Yeah. So can you kind of paint a picture of what this pill mill looked like, what the patients looked like, what the process of them getting the meds was? Because I don't know that most of us have that sort of image in our head to reference.
Right. So when I officially got the job, which I had to basically wiggle my way into, when they gave me the position, I was hired as the office manager of a pain clinic in Savannah, Georgia, which they were transferring me from Florida to Georgia. And I had no doctor office experience, no medical experience at all. So they're like, yeah, we're going to have some nurses on staff that are going to train you. But before we place you in the actual pain clinic, we need you to do some marketing for us. They had me and a couple of guys with walkie-talkies or rental car go rent a hotel room in Jacksonville off of Blanding Boulevard across the street from one of the largest pain clinics in the United States at this point, owned by the George Brothers, who there's a Netflix documentary on now. You can go and view that. But while we were there, they would have somebody up in the hotel. They'd have me and another guy like down in the car. And when they would see an out-of-plate tag from like Ohio, Kentucky, wherever, pull into this pain clinic, they'd wait until they would leave, then they'd call us on the radio to go flag this person down to basically, you know, run them off the road, convince them next time they're going to go to a pain clinic instead of coming to this one, which is so far away, stop in Georgia. It's less of a trip. But you would see the type of people that we were kind of pulling over in sense. They, you know, most of them were barefoot. They look like they haven't showered in days, a lot of missing teeth, very just disheveled, hadn't showered. Looked very confused, looked very, very high. And at this point, I really didn't have much of a picture of what a pain clinic was. So I didn't know how bad the opioid addiction was. You would see kids in the car. That was the sad part. You see like little kids in the car that just, you know, their parents didn't have anybody to watch them. So they took them for this, you know, 3 or 4 day road trip. And it was a very disheartening, kind of almost like an internal darkness that you'd feel while you're doing this. You knew something was wrong, but you couldn't quite place your finger on it because you're still trying to lie to yourself for the potential money that you thought you might be able to make. Agreed.
Oh my gosh. That is so dismal sounding.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that about the Jacksonville reconnaissance.
Yeah, that was their marketing. When they said we're going to have you do marketing for us before they sent me there. When they said marketing, I'm thinking Facebook ads, Google AdWords.
Yeah. No,
they're talking about straight up poaching your competition. And it got bad. I mean, the competition would come after us with bats and cops would show up. And there was a part of it that was exciting because it was exhilarating. But the other part of it was like, fuck, I think I might get killed one day out here doing this. I didn't know that was going to be part of it at all. When they told me what a pain clinic was, they kind of described it as an urgent care clinic. But when they said $10,000 a month, they were basically like, you know, they justify that with, we need somebody that can manage everybody. We need somebody that can keep track of the money. They're going to be overseeing day-to-day operations. I mean, they made it sound like there was going to be a lot of legitimate side to it. But if you'd have been standing in my place listening to them, Meredith, you probably would have ran the other direction because it was basically like having Tony Soprano and his goons kind of outlining the business plan.
Yeah, and your first clue should have been like, here's some walkie-talkies, here's a hotel key. Yeah. Like that should have been like, red alert, run away.
They had us go into motels in the middle of the night looking for out-of-plate tags saying, if anybody's sleeping in a motel and it looks like they got pillows and blankets, they're probably on their way to a pain clinic. So we put cards on their cars. It was unearthly weird to be doing any of this.
You know, the thing, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but the thing that I appreciate about your story so much is that you have this part of it that's completely hilarious because it's too weird to be true, and yet it is.
If it
and
didn't
then this
kill
part
so many
of it,
people and destroy so many lives, you could make this
exactly
into a pretty good comedy. Absolutely.
Exactly. And then that's the other part, is it's like, this is so sad. And okay, so let's fast forward just a teeny bit to when your marketing is over and you're actually in the office.
Right.
I'm wondering about the timeline because I was reading about when kind of the opioid epidemic kind of coming to an official end, right? Because you were arrested in 2014. And I want to say, according to Wikipedia, it was like 2016, 2017.
I was arrested in 2011.
Oh, 2011.
I didn't go to prison until 2014. Yeah, they had already started shutting down states. This is why we had to go to Georgia versus Florida. We lived in Florida, and the reason why they could not open the clinics in Florida was they could open a clinic in Florida, but the problem was you could not prescribe a medication and dispense out of the same doctor's office. They'd passed a bill in Florida that you couldn't do that anymore. So by going to Georgia, crossing state lines, you can now own a doctor's office and prescribe out of the same location. So you can not only charge them for the visit, but you can now, the real money that was to be made was on the prescriptions itself, because you could charge 20, 30, these people, most of them didn't have insurance. So they'd pay $20, $30 a pill. So these, the owners of the pain clinic really identified how they could become glorified, legitimate drug dealers under the scope of the pretenses of the law. So they were already watching us before we even opened our doors there.
Oh, okay. That is a very helpful piece of the puzzle. And when you said these clinic owners, you're talking about medical physicians, real doctors.
No. So the owners of my clinic were a guy named Louis Trimatera, a gangster out of Boca Raton, Florida, who ultimately didn't go to prison. And another guy.
He didn't go to prison.
No, he bought his way out of it and they violated his corporation. They gave his corporation probation. He spent about $5 to $10 million on avoiding this, in addition to his attorney's fees. The doctors that they hired there were not owners of the physician or were not owners of the clinic. The doctors were just paid daily. They were paid anywhere from $1,700 to like $3,000 per day cash for working at the clinic. The doctor that they originally hired, Dr. Azmat, he's the one that brought it all down. Dr. Azmat apparently was already being watched. He had bounced around from other pain clinics and he had been banned from these other places for overprescribing. He had all of his medical licenses restricted, except for some reason they were still letting him prescribe. He couldn't do any other procedures. He couldn't perform surgeries. But once he got there, the patients started complaining because he wasn't writing heavy enough scripts. And in the scripts that he was writing, none of the pharmacies would fill because his name was already on like a red list. So he was only there 3 days before he got fired. And then they hired another guy, Dr. Gossett. But Dr. Azmat, he's the one, they were already watching him. The feds already had their eyes on him. So when he came to our clinic, he brought the heat with him.
Oh my gosh. I have so many thoughts about that. Yeah. Wow. Okay. That is complicated. And I'm kind of like dumbfounded by the fact that the person who initiated this situation never had prison time. Like he bought his way out of it. Yep. And you had prison time. The inmates had prison time. I think your girlfriend receptionist, right? Yep. She had prison time. And you had the same prison time as the doctors.
Well, right? Two doctors. The doctor that was there for 3 days who got fired for not writing heavy enough, he ended up getting an 11-year sentence because he wouldn't take a plea deal. The doctor that was there the majority of the time, Dr. Gossett, took a plea deal and he got the same sentence as me, 42 months.
So for the process from initial arrest to conviction, what did that feel like for you?
Well, man, it's such a memory that you try to stomp out just because it's like, even listening to you read the beginning of this, when you're like Georgia Pain Clinic, it reminds me of watching the news, the headlines when we were in the news. I tell everybody going to prison sucked for sure. Nobody wants to go to prison, but the real prison sentence was from the time of the initial contact in 2011, when we got, raided by the feds, until I actually went to prison in 2014. Because, you're hit with all these original charges, these conspiracies and RICOs and, every charge under the sun. It was like a 42 count indictment. And if I had gone to trial and lost on these counts, it would have been 25 years to life in prison for, working at a doctor's office, not justifying it all. But it was by far the worst feeling in the world because I have little kids and I'm like, how do I tell my kids I'm going to go to prison for 20 years? Not to mention, everything and anything I knew about prison was what I saw on TV, the TV show Oz, where people are getting, raped and extorted and beat up every day. And you just think prison's going to be like that. And you're like, what should I do? Only thing I could do is start gaining weight and growing out a gnarly beard and thinking if I was fat, dirty, and smelly, no one was going to rape me or molest me. These were legitimate thoughts that went through my mind until I actually got there. It was quite the emotional roller coaster. Best way I can explain it is if you've ever had a family member that was dying of cancer and you knew they were going to die, you just didn't know exactly when, and you're trying to go visit them and it's really eating into like your regular life. As sad as that sounds, when somebody's passing away, it takes up a lot of your time because it's emotional and nothing you can do to stop it. It's like watching somebody die slowly without any ability to step in. So it really felt like I was just watching myself slowly die and everybody around me, because I'm still out on pretrial at this time. I'm still out in the real world. People are going on trips and buying houses and thinking about what they're going to do next month. And hey, Dan, we're all going to go on a ski trip. You want to go? And it's like, fuck, man, I might be expired by then. I don't know where my life is going to be in 30 days. So as much as it was nice to be out that entire time, at the same time, the amount of distress that's over your head is you don't enjoy one day of it. Every single day when the phone rings, you're thinking like, I'm going to be in prison.
And you shared with me off mic that you considered suicide. Is that pretty common for your clients that goes through their minds a lot?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people in general watching this at some point have been in a down spot in their life where I'm not going to say they attempted suicide, but the suicide crosses people's minds when you get into a negative boo-hoo, woo-was-me spot. But yeah, I definitely did, you know, started drinking a lot. I wasn't big into drugs at all at that point. So it was more of like an alcoholic induced, you know, I didn't have enough money to fight this. This isn't fair. The government's coming after to get me. Why didn't my parents teach me better? I was blaming everybody under the sun to the point where it felt so awful that, you know, escaping reality seemed like a good alternative to the point where I was sitting in my closet with something around my neck, you know, hanging, getting ready to just kind of sit down and take the stress off and, you know, say lights out. But, you know, my little dog, Ted, sitting there looking at me and just kind of, I don't know, something snapped out of it real quick. So it would have been real easy to do it, but that wouldn't have been a solution. You know, that just would have caused more chaos and wreckage throughout my entire life with everybody that's left behind. But yeah, the thought was definitely there. And fleeing, and you know, going on the run was definitely there too.
And this must be so interesting now for you to connect with your clients who are having all this stuff go through their minds. But you didn't have the benefit of having someone like you helping you at that moment. No. You did the Hail Mary YouTube video asking for advice. And so when you came out of prison and you were able to like look at the video and see what was going on and seeing it was getting a lot of traction and you made the business from it, who then became your very first client? Do you remember?
Yeah, actually, if you Google Hunter Moore, Revenge Porn King, they did a Netflix special on him.
Wow, way to like start things off with a bang. That was your first client.
He was my first client. He wasn't my first paid client. He was my first client. I was doing the consulting from my little office. I was still living in the federal halfway house at this time, but I started getting this this message on, I forgot what it was, email or whatever. And it was a guy who was his handle was That Fish Scale. And apparently fish scale is like code for cocaine, which I had no idea at that time. And he just kept asking me kind of questions. He didn't want to tell me who he was. And I started answering his questions. Finally, one day he's like, hey, I need your help. I'm going to give you my name, but please don't Google me. That was his first thing he said. And of course, when you tell somebody, please don't Google me, I don't care who you are, first thing you're going to do is hop on Google. I thought it was going to be some kind of like child pornography type of a thing, the way he said, don't Google me. So when I looked it up, he had a website called Is Anybody Up Yet? Or Are You Still Up Yet? Or something to that effect, where let's say you and your husband or you and your ex-boyfriend made a provocative sex tape and you guys break up. He would take the boyfriend would submit that information to his website and put you kind of viral. Then they'd put your YouTube your Facebook stuff on there, all your personal information, kind of ruining these women's lives. And he started hacking computers to get the information to get stuff that he didn't already have. Long story short, he got indicted, went to prison and reached out for my help, but really made it sound like he didn't do as much as he did. And it did sound a little far-fetched because the government is known for overreaching. So I did believe him to an extent, but come to find out later on, he was pretty guilty. But he was my very first client, Hunter Moore.
Jeez. Okay. Well, I know that from talking with you that helping guys like that is not exactly, you know, your favorite, right?
No.
Your goal is to help the person who... Go ahead.
And it's not just helping that individual. You got to remember, even the worst of the worst, it could be a sex offender, their families are still going through the worst time of their life as well. So a lot of the work that we do, even if we don't necessarily agree with the person that is going to prison, we're also working through with their family members to help them realize that through accountability and owning what you've done to put yourself in the situation is really the only absolution you're going to get. People are not going to cleanse themselves of what they've done until they stop blaming everybody else. We've had some amazing clients. We had Todd Hansen, I think his name was. Todd Hansen was a guy that was just out of control. He was a white collar criminal, just really thought he was above the law and caught an indictment, became suicidal. And through our work with him, you know, he would see the change of process because he originally thought he was hiring us just to maybe reduce his sentence. He didn't realize all of the mental work that was going to go into this, almost working as like a life coach in some ways or a therapist without any kind of a license. It's really helping you own and take accountability and realize that you can't just spend a ton of money and go in there and show the court how many friends you have of influence. You know, my friend's a judge, Your Honor, give me a shorter sentence. it's really taking ownership and understanding the impact of your crime. You'll hear all these crimes say they're victimless crime. But when you go to prison, you're leaving your kids behind, your parents, your mother, your best friend, and all these people want to believe that there's a good side of you. But when you sit there and tell them that you didn't do anything wrong, that they're just coming after you to take your money, most people know you're full of shit and they're just tired of your hearing your lies. So they stop calling you out on it. So seeing somebody turn that corner working with us where you see that mental breakdown where they'll start crying and they'll start to open up. It's like watching somebody just vomit all of the negative out of their body and they finally give up to like serenity, wherever you want to look at that, from religious purposes to people and motivational speakers. Once you give up and realize you don't have all the answers and you need somebody else's help to figure out your problems, you'll see people start going through the process of change. And that's really what we've enjoyed the most out of this, is seeing people come out better than who they were when they went in.
So personally, how do you maintain that balance between being non-judgmental, like all, you know, kind of the stuff, the perspective that you just shared of there's families connected to this, there's grandmas that are connected to this, but also not buying into their bullshit of the master manipulator, and also not swinging into the dangerous territory of this is connected to your paycheck? Like, how do you maintain that center space between all of those dynamics?
I don't know if I really know the complete answer to that, other than this has never been about money for us. You know, if you watch the very, very first videos, we weren't charging at all. Obviously, it's we have to make money to live. But I went so far outside of my means to survive prior to this. Like every time, if I'd make a dollar, I was spending 95 cents of it on appearances and what I thought everybody else should have. Now I have very minimal costs. I don't spend a lot of money, so I don't have to really worry about chasing tons and tons of clients to pay the bills. So money is definitely not an issue. When it comes to the accountability part, I believe the reason why people hire me, a lot of the things that we'll hear, because there's a couple of other consultants out there in the arena. And when people end up calling me, most of them will say, you know, Dan, I checked out you. I checked out a couple of other guys. And you seem to be the most real. You seem to be the most connectable. I feel like I'm talking to somebody that I'd be sitting in a bar stool talking to. Hearing somebody tell me these stories about, I was doing this crime, da da da. It's like, wait. At some point, I get it. You didn't plan to go out and like Dr. Evil the world. But if you could redo everything right now, I'm sure you can see some of the red flags, and there's something you would have done different. So if we can just focus on that one thing that you could have done different, instead of how unfair this is that the feds kick your doors in and are knocking your front teeth out right now, you ultimately let them into your life. So where did your life go awry that you let that happen? And sometimes getting somebody to go to the end the right way, what their intentions are initially doesn't really matter. If I start telling people, look, I know you're not where you need to be yet mentally, but if you really do want the best sentence possible and you want the judge to believe you, you got to start bullshitting yourself right now through accountability. At least start walking the walk. And you usually see people start going down the path of trying to be accountable. And then some way it segues into they actually realize this is fucking working and I feel better. I'm sleeping better at night. I don't want to kill myself anymore. And it will usually start with their kids. You know, they'll go to their kids and say, hey, I messed up. As long as their kids are old enough, I messed up. Here's the mistakes I made. How does this make you guys feel? What questions do you have? A lot of families don't want to talk to their loved ones that committed the crime. Like if your husband committed a crime and you see how stressed he is, the last thing you want to do is go to his face and go, what the F were you thinking? Why would you destroy our entire family like this? You know, when I walked down the aisle and said, I do, the last thing I was thinking was you're going to go to prison and leave me hanging with all these bills and the children. The problem is most families don't feel comfortable enough to bring that up because they think it's going to strike a chord. They're going to turn into an argument. In a lot of cases, it will. But when I get the defendant into the mind frame of they bring that to the family and say, you can ask me about this and I promise I'm not going to go off on you, almost bringing it to their attention, that's when you'll see a lot of the negative energy come out. Because if you don't do it now, when you get into prison and you're leaving your loved ones behind, when now they're figuring everything out after you've left, they really start to process. And that's when the anger and the resentment comes out. And now you're sitting in jail with 15-minute phone calls trying to kind of debate this back into a cycle of reality. So dealing with it before they go, it really does kind of explode, but then it kind of heals itself before they go, if that makes sense. I know I just unpacked a lot there.
I mean, that's the part that I think is hard to see on your website, because you can say mindset coaching, like it's a one bullet on your website, but what you just unpacked really makes a lot of sense. Like I interviewed my husband's cousin on the show way back in episode 18, 19, and I feel like I really had the privilege of understanding more of what that feels like and what that looks like than definitely anything I understood before. And you're right, there are complicated family, emotional, and relationship dynamics there that not many people would be able to address in a way that someone like you who has been in that situation could address. But you're more than just a prison sentence mindset coach. Like you also help with some of the logistics, right? Can you talk about why someone would want to hire you from a logistics standpoint?
Yeah, the sentence reduction, you know, not everybody's going to be a client for us. If you're facing a federal prison sentence because you gunned down a family of four, you probably are going to pass RDAP Dan in the phone book because there's not much I can do for a situation like that. But for a lot of these individuals, like white collar crime, you know, capital riots, you name it, PPP fraud, SBA fraud, when it comes time for the accountability portion of it, everybody that's going through this for the first time that's never been in trouble before, they all feel like it's the first, like nobody's gone through this before. They think that there's something unique about their situation, that the judge is going to see that they're a really good guy and they have kids at home and they shouldn't go to prison because they're doing great things in their community. You know, all that bullshit that runs through their head becomes their worst enemy because they start going through that mindset. And really, that's what the judge sees every single day. There's nothing new about that. So we really focus on personal narratives, character reference letters, and pre-sentence report preparation. The personal narratives and the character reference letter, that's going to be the letter that you're going to write to the judge on your behalf as the defendant. And then it's going to be the letter that your friends and family are writing on their behalf to the judge as to what they see as your character. We don't want those letters to look like every other letter the judge has seen. So if you're writing a letter on behalf of your husband, you don't want the letter to be like, oh, my husband's a really good guy. He's a great father. He made a mistake. He's sorry. Your Honor, please go easy on him. We have a small child at home. This is going to be so hard on the child. That's the real victim in the case. You know, that's all true, but the judge is just going to negate all that and say, well, sweetie, your husband should have thought about that before he fucking went off and committed a bunch of crimes, which that's the reality. You know, why wasn't your husband thinking about that at that time? Why is it so important now because he's going to prison? So having you write letters around the aspect of, I can't believe the person I married made these kind of horrible decisions ruining our life. You know, you really want to go in and kind of attack him first, and then coming back with, the reason why I'm still supporting my husband is he's taking accountability for this. He's not blaming anybody. He's using this instance as a cautionary tale for my child. He's out getting involved in the community right now. He knows he's going to go to prison. He's looking forward to taking advantage of programs that are there so that he can make sure that he doesn't have the same type of mindset when he comes home. So whatever type of prison sentence Your Honor feels is fair, my husband's going to run with that. It's getting that mindset. So that kind of stuff can really stand out to a judge because it's not what a judge is used to seeing at all. And when a judge sees something for the first time, you really invoke a different response. You get the judge to raise his eyebrow and almost go, you know what? I feel like you do understand the impact of your crime. You're not just coming in here and parroting what everybody else says. So either, you know, a reduced sentence, maybe probation, which we see all the time. Then there's programs that people can qualify for that can reduce some of their time. And unfortunately, you have to qualify for some of these programs before you get into prison. It really takes place in what you're telling probation. And many times, substance abuse can be an issue, whether it's alcohol, prescription pills, marijuana, drinking too much wine, whatever it might be. When you get to probation, when the probation asks you, do you have any type of substance abuse problems? Most people will automatically say no. Then they get into prison and they realize there's a program in there that can reduce your sentence. And when they try to go get it, the RDAP coordinator or the prison psychologist will review straight to your pre-sentence report under the substance abuse area. And if it's not outlined in there that you had some sort of an issue 12 months prior to the arrest of the instant offense, they, at that point, they'll say, oh, you don't qualify because you did not disclose this earlier on. And the fucked up thing is many times the attorney will tell them, don't mention it. Or the attorney won't tell them how important it is because they don't have a full grasp on what happens after your sentence. We're not here to do the attorney's job, but this is why so many criminal defense law firms hire us now, because the work that we do is just outside of the scope of what they do. It's not stuff that they focus on. So if the client prepares properly for the best possible outcome, whatever that's going to be down the road is going to start by them preparing for the release today, not once they get to prison.
Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals.
If you're new here, you may be surprised to know that the beautiful backdrop of my show is not a virtual screen. It's a real place that you can really rent inside of the Pensacola Museum of History. The exhibit space is called Trader John's. It's an old bar in Pensacola whose owner was just as eclectic as this town. And it's perfect for birthdays, work events, award ceremonies, retirement parties, family reunions. So don't pick another boring venue space for your next event. Give the Pensacola Historic Trust your business and make your event super memorable. Learn more at historicpensacola.org. The weather is cooling down here in the southern U.S., and that means it's fire ant season. For those of you not from the south, fire ants are about as pleasant as they sound, and their bites pus up into an itchy red mess that takes forever to heal. I recommend InSec for pest management because I've been using their mosquito service since 2019, and I love that their work is guaranteed. If you're in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give InSec a call. It's ENSEC.net. Now back to the show. Remember to stay till the end where I give you a sneak peek of next week's episode.
There are so many opportunities to kind of mess up, to get tripped up along the way of between arrest and sentencing. There's so many things that can go wrong. I can see where someone would really benefit from having a prison consultant as a part of their team in addition to the attorney.
People that get caught up in the system, people that violate, they will always tell you the system was rigged against them. They'll always tell you it was fucked up and they did this to me. But the way it worked for me was I was working on myself from the day I got to prison, writing letters to dear future Dan. I wrote a letter every day I was in prison. Every time it was time to take pictures in prison, I was the only guy that smiled. People were like, why are you smiling? You know, everyone else is doing that prison pose, getting down low. Because I don't want this to be like, I don't want to come out of here and go, look how hard I was in prison. I want to come out of here and go, I used my prison experience to better my life. I tell people religiously that prison was an overwhelming positive experience for me because it really did ground my thoughts to the point when I was talking to my girlfriend on the phone. She had already gotten out and I was talking about all these changes I wanted to make and how I was looking forward to just like a simple life. And I remember her saying, whatever Kool-Aid they're giving you in there, I hope you take the recipe home with you. So things like that stuck out in my head because that's ultimately what keeps people out of prison is not allowing yourself to go back to that old way of thinking. You can't hang out with the same people. You can't go in the same neighborhoods. If I get into a car and I don't know somebody, I ask them, do you have any guns or drugs on you? And they're looking at me like, why the fuck would I have guns and drugs on me? Well, I'm a convicted felon. And if you do and throw them on the floorboard, it's being able to hold your friends and family accountable, you know, telling people what they need to hear, not necessarily what they want to hear. And when you get yourself trained around that type of mindset, it's highly unlikely you're going to put yourself into one of those undesirable situations again.
I never thought about if you're a convicted felon and you get into a car with other people to ask them, excuse me, boys and girls, do you have any guns or alcohol or guns and drugs on you?
I mean, obviously, I wouldn't ask that to you. But if we're all out drinking at a bar and we're like, hey, we're going to go to this place. Like, hey, can my friend come with me? It's like, hey, you know, you might be a licensed carrying, but God forbid that might be the one time you got cocaine on you and we get pulled over and you toss it on the ground. You know, it's being able to say those things out loud is what can save your life.
Okay. Well, speaking of cocaine, that was something that kind of tripped you up after you got out. Would you like to share about that?
Sure. Yeah. Drugs were not my thing. Even when I was younger, like I was terrified of drugs, smoke a little bit of weed here and there and drink a little bit. But my 40th birthday, I just turned 45, November 27th. So my 40th birthday, well, after all of this had gone through, I'm a consultant and every Thursday night we'd play poker. And this one guy, he would always bring a little bit. I was off of everything. I wasn't on paper or anything like that. So it didn't really matter to me. I wasn't using it. And on my 40th birthday, for some reason, when they offered it to me and asked me if I wanted to try it, normally I would have said no. And I was like, okay. And I tried cocaine and it just grabbed a hold of me in a way that I wasn't expecting. I really just assumed that I did not have an addictive personality because I'd never done drugs. And really, I think what it was is subconsciously, something told me, don't try these, Dan, you're going to love them. And cocaine was a wonderful drug. Anybody that's done it for any period of time, they'll tell you it changes your mood. Everything is euphoric. You love everybody. But what they don't tell you is the come down off of it, the money that it's going to spend, the way that you'll start choosing that over your family, you'll start choosing that over meetings, you'll start choosing that over your consultations. You start to see it take a toll. And eventually, before you know it, there's cracks in your entire foundation. And I was lucky enough to have a good support system around me. My savior from cocaine was telling my girlfriend and friends, if I start acting weird, or I'm not answering the phone, or I'm not showing up for like my morning gym meetings, there's a good chance that I did something the night before that I'm embarrassed of. Because coming off of a cocaine bender, the last thing you want to do is you want to go around people. You're tired, you can't talk, you're sleepy. So holding myself accountable by telling other people what my triggers were and what to look for if I was relapsing, it made it real hard for me to even do it at all, because it got to the point where people were asking me, are you doing it? And I wasn't. They were so aware of the problem persisting itself that they were constantly checking on me for about a year until I got it back under control. But I saw, you know, I burnt about $100,000 in 7 months on cocaine and just alcohol and sharing it with everybody, burning through cryptocurrency. It can take a strong toll. And I got lucky that it didn't lead into any type of criminal enterprises again, because, you know, when you're in a mindset like that, it's real easy to think, hey, I just burned through $100,000. I need to go make this money back. What can I do real quick?
Wow. It can happen. It can happen to any of us, really. Yeah. And that's what's, again, going back to kind of what we were talking about at the beginning, the bringing it home of who can be someone who experiences prison, who is someone who can get caught up in opioid addiction, who's someone who could be on the business end of opioid addiction, kind of like you said, the criminal enterprise. So to close this out today, I love your final thoughts on this. It's something that might come out a little clunky, but I think between the two of us, we can figure out.
No, I can't wait for this one.
So I'm just curious what your take is on the business of prison, right? The system, if you will. That's not a great word for it, but when I say this, the business of prison, I'm talking about the really big web of what makes your story, the cocaine story that could have happened, what makes it all possible, the people who own the opioid clinics, who used to own them, the MDs, the people like you who turned a blind eye, you know, the prison systems that profit from this revolving door of substance and all of it. But then also, if the system wasn't there, you wouldn't have a business. So you're really the perfect guest for this show. I don't know if you knew that, but I love guests that you're like, I can't decide how I feel about this. That's something I just treasure so much, where you get sort of lost in the nuance of it, and you really start to see the people as people. But my question is, do you have any thoughts on kind of the enterprise of it all, being someone who has been on the receiving end of it, and now you're a part of the, you might call, the service end of it?
Yeah. So that's a tough question, because
it is. Yeah.
You're talking about, like, we all know that the prison system is a business, right? Okay. You got government prisons, private prisons, and without people committing crime, the problem is it goes so much deeper than that, to where until we're ready to go into like a collective consciousness as a singular thought process, where we really, I care about you as much as I care about me, or I care about your child as much as I care about my child. And we don't live in a world like that. We don't. If my child and your child are hanging off a cliff, I'm going to go kick your child off to save my child. That's like humanity in a nutshell. And until we're ready to like care about others as much as we care about ourselves, you know, it's easy to say all of these things and the prison system is so bad, but if everybody in your city where you live all decided not to buy gasoline tomorrow, the gas prices would come down. But we won't do that because of our egos, of our own personal, what we care about for ourselves first. So the prison system, they know it's a business. They know what they're doing for sure. They know people are going to continue. We know people are going to break the law. Even like in my case, when they indicted us and got us, they watched us for a couple of months before they hit us. They watched us commit the crime. They knew what we were doing. They could have, if they really cared so much about getting drugs off the street, they would have shut us down day one, but they let it go and go and go because they could get a better case out of it. So there, in my opinion, the powers that be are just as evil as everybody else going through this. They're just, at worst, they're just as responsible as the person committing the crime. Even a lot of the like child pornography cases you see, a lot of it is the cops going out and putting out fake underage pictures, trying to troll these people in to arrest them. And they put them in jail for a couple of years with no real repercussions. They get back out and they repeat same crime. So the revolving door of the business side of it, it's very disgusting, but I think we have to, you know, pick and choose what parts of it we can play a role in, where we can help. And there's such a strong presence of prison reform. The problem is it becomes left versus right. The right side, you know, I'm wearing a Trump hat, so clearly I kind of like display my beliefs on my sleeves. But just because I'm wearing this hat, a lot of people would say, well, you must hate all gay people. You must be against gay marriage. You must be a racist. And the reality is, you know, it's the opposite. I have a lot of thoughts and beliefs that don't align with that type of a thought process. But we judge people based on what we see. And because we're so divided, you'll see people base their choices based on, they'll pick it the same way they pick like a sports team. They don't really put much thought and process into it. If we could kind of put left and right aside and say what's better for humanity, forget about all of the politics, the prison system would probably dwindle away. We'd be able to actually get people help, mental health support, all of these things that they need instead of just shoving pills down their throat. A lot of people that go into the prison system with severe addiction, a lot of it comes from severe trauma as a child they went through. Not to make that as an excuse, but you don't just fix that with some medication and a prison sentence that doesn't offer any true reform. Now, reform in prison is a whole other concept. They can't force you to do prison reform. When you go into prison, they're not going to make you go take classes. You know, you have to put your mindset in, I want to come out better than when I went in. So I chose to take classes. I chose to better myself. I chose to stay away from the gambling. I chose to stay away from the sports. I chose to stay away from all the drugs and activity that were in prison because it was just as prevalent there as it was in the streets. So you really have to, at some point, as an adult, unless you don't have the mental capacity to do it, you have to think about what's going to be better for me. That's going to be better for the people around me. And if you can align those stars and say, I'm doing things for the right reasons, everything else will fall in place. If you don't do that, you're always going to be part of the problem, or you're always going to be one of the victims that's blaming everybody else. So it's not going to get fixed until you can truly help yourself first. Then you can start to fix the problem.
So a dissolution of ego and personal responsibility. Those.
Yeah, why did I just say that?
Because what you said was way more interesting. I liked the way that you said it. I appreciate you having this conversation with me. This was really, really cool. And I'm glad that there are services like the one that you have. So tell people where they can engage with those services if they need them or a loved one needs them. And then, of course, about your podcast and YouTube channel.
Best way to find me is on most social media platforms, YouTube being the biggest, RDAP Dan. That's RDAPDAN. That stands for Residential Drug Abuse Program. My website is federalprisontime.com. You can also go to RDAPDAN.com. You can also call me, 509-434-4695. We have a free 15-minute consultation that, very worst case scenario, you'll leave that consultation with a little bit more information you had before you went into it. So I hope to hear from you. People Helping People, Communities Method, one day at a time.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, you'll also like the one that we referred to in the episode, the one with a felon turned million-dollar entrepreneur. It's episode 18, all the way back. And you know, they say word of mouth is still the best way for a podcast to grow. So since you made it this far, now's a great time to take a screenshot and share about it on social media. Be sure to tag me. I'm at Meredith For Real. Stay tuned next week when I talk with a mental health counselor as we ask the question, why do people stay with their abusers?